From WXXI News in Rochester, this is Connections. I'm Scott Flybush, in for Evan Dawson, and if you are like most of us, you've probably never thought all that deeply about exactly what bass Paul McCartney was playing or what kind of drums Ringo Starr was pounding on when the Beatles recorded their biggest hits. But fortunately for all of us, someone has thought deeply about those questions, and he is right here in Rochester. Maybe you know Andy Bubuke from his many years with the Chesterfield Kings or later in the Empty Hearts. Maybe you know him from his more recent role as the leading expert on the instruments that the Beatles and the Rolling Stones used during their careers. In 2001, Andy published the first edition of Beatles Gear, more than 200 pages of newly uncovered information about what the band was playing and where all those instruments ended up. He followed that up as the co-author of Rolling Stones Gear in 2013. He's also written the story of Paul Bigsby, father of the modern electric solid body guitar. And in the decade and a half since the first edition of Beatles Gear, Andy uncovered enough new information and photos to literally double the size of the book. It was re-released in 2015 as Beatles Gear, the Ultimate Edition. Andy now works as a consultant to movies, auction houses, and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he has his own store in Fairport, Andy Bubuke's Fab Gear. And as our summer book week continues here on Connections, Andy is right here in studio with us and taking your questions as well at 844-295-TALK on Twitter at Scott Flybush. Andy, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It is a delight to have you here. Your role as a Beatles expert certainly has become pretty well known in the community. And I want to start with just the sheer size of this. We were talking before we went on the air about the heft of this book. This is one hefty volume here.
It's almost 700 pages, some 690 pages, something like, I don't know, but it's heavy. A big coffee table book, hardcover. So I always joke with people, when you lift it, you could always use it as a defense weapon to bludgeon somebody if you have to.
You could. The first edition of this, I remember when this came out right around the turn of the century and being amazed at how much research had gone into this, at how many photos you had scrutinized to figure out exactly which instrument was which and which knobs got replaced when.
Sure.
And what got repainted and which Ludwig logo was on which drum head. And then you've got twice that amount of information in here. What happened after the first book that led to this? Give me some ideas of some of the better stuff that came out of the woodwork between editions here.
Well, it's interesting because when the first book came out, it was really well received. It sold over 150,000 copies, and it was, there's a lot of famous people that had it, and they'd tell me how they really enjoyed it and stuff. And I was, you know, flattered to... The Beatles themselves, you know, Paul really liked it, Ringo really liked it, Yoko liked it, Olivia Harrison, as they refer to it all the time, you know.
It's got to be an amazing feeling to even be sitting here saying that.
Yeah, well, it's a little like you pinch yourself and go, wow, I guess I did something cool, you know, where the people who you write about actually enjoy it. But, you know, I'm pretty accessible. Like you said, I have a shop in Fairport, and so 9 times out of 10, if you ring there, you know, you get a hold of me on the phone or email. So I constantly get email and phone calls. I have George Harrison's this or John Lennon's this all the time. 99.9% of the time, it's nothing, okay? But you never know. So I always say, send me a photo. And lo and behold, things would start popping up. One time I got an email from a guy. No, it was a Facebook thing. You know, internet's great. You got to remember, when I did the first book, there wasn't really internet as we know it now. It was in the 90s, so I had to do it all old school, you know, via mail, FedEx, and, you know, fax machines.
Expensive long-distance
phone
calls to Europe.
Very expensive long-distance phone calls, yeah. But since the internet, a lot more information's available. So I got this guy contacted me from Facebook. I've got John Lennon's Gretsch, you know, that he used in paperback writer. I go, all right, well, send me a picture. And sure enough, because you could match the wood grain, and I have this massive archive of photos, I was able to, like, match it up. And so I sent him a Facebook message or whatever they call them. And, hey, can I have your phone number? I'd like to talk to you. He was in England, in London. Just call him up. And I said, so let me ask you something. How did you get this guitar? And he tells me, John was my cousin. You know, I go, really? So when I was doing work on the Rolling Stones book, I went to his home and we photographed it. So a lot of things like that happened. You know, that's just one instance, but there was a ton of it. And you know, photos, I got stuff from Ringo, you know, Paul McCartney was, you know, I got stuff from him. It was interesting because then it just helped complete the whole piece of work.
So let's rewind a little bit. By the time the first book had come out, you had already made contact, particularly with Ringo, who needed help figuring out what he had in storage mm-hmm. and where all of it had come from. Going back even before that, let's really get back as it were. That was lame. Let's really get back and talk about where your interest in this started. I mean, you've been a musician now for 3 decades. Everybody respects the Beatles. Everybody loves the Beatles. Sure. Not everybody is fascinated by what particular model of Gretsch happened to be in George Harrison's hands. What sparked this for you?
Well, you know, just to answer that part of the question first, you know, a lot of people, yeah, you're right. You know, they're not interested. But if you stop and you think, and when I do these lectures for Beatles Care, I'm able to actually play audio clips and, you know, we show a lot of extra photos and stuff. But like, what if, you know, we know all these songs so well, we hear them on the radio. It's a soundtrack to, you know, a generation, really. So we know these songs intimately, but if you were to hear the exact same songs with different instruments played, they sound drastically different. And I give examples because I have all these outtakes of them in the studio where they are using different instruments, and the songs tend to sound very, very much different. So that's one point. But the other thing is, you know, there's going to come a time where, you know, 7,500 years from now, this music will still exist, but people won't know how do they create it, you know? They'll talk about how they wrote it, what kind of drugs they took, who they were sleeping with, all that stuff. But, you know, I mean, the tools of the trade, I think, are just as important, if not more important, because that's how the music was created. And a lot of points, I point this out in the book, is the instruments themselves actually helped them you know, create the songs as far as inspirational, like the Rickenbacker 12-string. It created a certain mood and stuff. Things like an Indian sitar, you know, that really changed the music of that song.
The Mellotron.
The Mellotron. Yeah, you could go, it's an endless list. So if you start really taking a look at it, it's fascinating. I'll tell you what, I guarantee you read the book, it'll make you go back and listen to the Beatles songs totally differently.
Oh, absolutely. When you started doing your research on this, was there what was out there at that point?
Well, as I said, there was no internet really, and so the idea of a website that you could go and like look up, so there's no Wikipedia, nothing. I mean, I was a big fan. Being in the Chesterfield Kings, we always strive to make our records sound like our favorite bands. So when we went in to record, we wanted to sound like the Rolling Stones or the Beatles or the Kinks or the Who or whatever. And so we would buy similar type of guitars. We'd figure out, okay, you got to buy a Rickenbacker if you want that. Maybe get a Vox amp. But then there's different kinds of amps. There's different kinds. So being into the music industry myself, as far as equipment goes, I was very into vintage stuff, and that's my forte. So it just kind of evolved to the point of like, really being hugely interested in just collecting a ton of photos and every Beatle book that was ever published, anything, you know, and you physically had to collect it. It wasn't like you could just go on the internet and grab the picture and store it on your computer.
I'm guessing it didn't exist. House of Guitars helped.
Well, yeah, I worked there for years and years, and so I was in contact with a lot of people. And as a matter of fact, you know, often people would come in and they'd say, I want to get a Vox Super Beatle like the Beatles had. And then they'd say, oh, you got to talk to Andy. And then, like, you know, I'd go and talk to the guy. And it would literally become, like, somewhat of an argument with the customer. The guy would be, you know, oh, well, I remember the Beatles used Vox Super Beatles in the studio. And I go, well, actually, they didn't. Those were American-made. They used tube amps, which were British-made. And they were actually the AC-50, AC-100s. That kind of looks like it, but not. And you get in an argument, it'd be great frustration. And then the guy didn't want to buy it anyhow. So, like, you go back in the office and go, oh, no. And then all the guys would be laughing, oh, another Beatle geek. And I go, oh,
Bruce
yeah.
Bruce must have loved that.
No, it was just the guys that I worked with. There was a guy by the name of Steve White who worked there. It was good, still a very, very good friend of mine. And it was like some Friday evening or something, and he goes, they're all laughing, you know, we're having a beer or something. And he says, you know, Andy, if you actually locked yourself in your house for the weekend and wrote down everything you know about the Beatles equipment, you know, get a case of beer and just like do it, you'd have a book. And I go, wow, that's kind of like a, that was literally the spark of it. him telling me to do that. And he said it would take a weekend. And like 6 years later, I owe him a punch in the arm, you know? We always joke about that. But that was really the spark of it. You know, it was never cataloged. It was never done.
Did you ever envision yourself as a writer with a published book?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, English wasn't my strong subject in school or in college. It wasn't my thing. I'm a numbers guy more than that. So writing, I had no formal training in it. It was just a passion. I wanted to tell the story. And I kind of wrote the book the way I talk or the way I think, you know, from a musician's viewpoint. And people have told me that they rather like the style.
Was it pretty much a given? You know, the book is very chronologically organized year by year. Here's what they were playing at the very beginning. Here's what they had in 62 and in 63 and later on. Was that pretty much a given that it was going to be a chronological history of what they played?
I just see things that way. And I think, you know, having a lot of books myself, I've got a massive library. I don't like when books skip around. It's really confusing. And if you want to write a reference book, you really need to make it a reference book so that you could actually go and at any point you can know where you are in a period of time. The original book had that aspect to it, but I didn't have the control of that book as far as layout. The new book, I had 100% control. I worked with a graphics artist, Paul Cooper, in London, and we worked out the whole book. Page by page, exactly how I wanted to see it. Where I write about a certain topic, there's photos accordingly, you know. And at any point, you could pop open the book, you'll know exactly where you are in the timeline.
And it is a magnificent piece of design also.
Oh, he did a wonderful job. I only saw it in my head, but he was the genius who actually laid it out.
There is a huge value to a good designer. We are talking with Andy Babiuk, who is the author of Beatles Gear, now out as the Ultimate Edition, over 500 and some pages, literally all the Fab Four's instruments from stage to studio. At what point did you make your first contact with an actual Beatle? How did that come about?
It was George Harrison initially, and George, they had just finished up doing all the anthology stuff, and so George's wife Olivia, her sister was like their secretary, so to speak, you know. So I was corresponding with her, and I said, "Look, this is what I'm doing," and she had told me that George was really beetled out, quote unquote. And I said, well, look, I don't really want to talk about the Beatles. Because if though you're talking about the Beatles, it's really about the equipment. It's about the instruments, you know. So I said, I have very specific questions about his musical equipment, you know. She goes, okay. So then she got back to me and says, well, George wants to see all your questions first. And I said, fair enough. So I literally had to fax them to him, you know. It was fax. And this is in the 90s. And I kept it brief, and I sent him a whole list of questions. And then all of a sudden, I hear that he got stabbed. Somebody broke into his home and got stabbed. And then I heard, you know, through his secretary that, you know, I stayed back for quite a while. And then when I circled back, you know, then I found out that, you know, he had cancer. So I thought, you know, that was very unethical to actually try to pursue it. You know, I thought it wasn't too cool. And then I worked with Ringo directly. I had to go, he gave me permission to go and photograph his drums. Now he thought he only had quote unquote bits and pieces. And I said, all right, well, I'll figure it out. Now, if you look at his drum set, it has the Oyster Black Pearl finish. It's like the way it's manufactured, there's no two the same. You know, it's like a fingerprint. So the anal me would figure out all these photos and figured out that he had four kits and there was two different sizes and you could see the swirl and I have all these pictures all laid out, you know, real nutty, and I have them all printed out. I go to London and they have a pile of Beatle-esque drums. And I go,
okay. It was all sitting in a warehouse somewhere?
Yeah. And I said, well, they go, well, we could just make up a set and you could photograph. I go, no, hang on, let me figure this, you know. And so I started matching up what goes to what, and I figured it all out. And his drum tech at the time, this guy Bill Harrison, called him. He was living in Monaco at the time. He said, Richie, this guy's figured out. You have three of your kits, three and a half, two of the drums from your first one. The guy figured it all out. And Ringo was really happy. So he goes, I want to meet the guy and I want to see what he did. So we photographed it. Somewhere there's a video of me playing one of the kits, you know, Ticket to Ride, of course, you know. And it was really fun. And we found also, I was digging around through his stuff and we found his gold snare drum that he was given, that Bill Ludwig gave him from Ludwig Drums. And Bill Ludwig was convinced that it was stolen, that a cop made off with it. And I was able to call Bill Ludwig after I was in London. I said, hey, by the way, that Ringo really does have that gold drum still. So anyhow, then I met with Ringo. He was rehearsing with the All-Star Band up in north of Toronto, Casino Rama or whatever. So he invited me up for a couple of days to hang out prior to the tour. And it was, you know, it was kind of a little surreal hanging out with Ringo. Yeah. But he wanted to sit down and actually see exactly what it was that I did. He goes, it's fascinating. You figured all this stuff out. And then he was looking at a galley of the book. It wasn't printed yet. And I'm showing it to him. And there's a picture of the Ed Sullivan drum head. And he goes and he's looking. He says, so that's my drum head. And I go, well, that's one of them. He goes, how's that? I go, well, you had seven of them. He goes, really? And, you know, I came prepared. I got all these photos. So I started showing him, well, this is your first drum head, and that's the second one. And they're all hand-done, and this guy did them in London for you. And he goes, really? I go, yeah, and this is this one, you know, and this is when you used it. And he's lifting his glasses. Mm-hmm. We're at this big table like this. He's lifting his glasses. He's squinting. He's looking at it. Then he grabs my arm. He goes, Andy, they all look the same to me. I go, yeah, but Ringo, they're all different. He goes, I think you're crazy. I go, that. Thanks, Ringo. I take that as a compliment. He was a swell guy. I mean, he was really cool. So, I mean, they were all great, especially like with the new book. Now that they saw the original book, and then I was able to go back. Yoko was really great. She's very, very helpful. Olivia Harrison, I actually got hired by their family to do the George Harrison app where you could download the app and spin all their guitars around and look at them. And McCartney was great. He gave me some really great Linda McCartney photos for the book and stuff. And of course, Ringo was really cool. So it's fun.
When do you ever get beyond that point of thinking, my God, I'm talking to a Beatle here? Is there a point where it just becomes business and it's okay, there are more drums we got to go through?
Well, you know, I play like in the Chesterfield Kings for years, and then now with my new band, The Empty Hearts, you kind of fly in kind of weird circles where you're like, you know, and I have a lot of friends that happen to be, you know, big celebrities and stuff, and they're just friends, you know. So with like Ringo, for instance, I just took my wife and my son to go visit with him. He was in Syracuse rehearsing. So I brought him a new copy. I sent him the new book to his home, and his assistant called me and he was really pissed because I didn't sign it. I have a real hard time signing books for celebrity people. I think it's arrogant or pompous or whatever. And so
Ringo, love you, man.
Yeah, you know, I just like, you know, we were having dinner before the Bruce Springsteen show with Little Steven and the guys in the band and stuff. And Steven asked me to bring a copy of the book for Bruce because Bruce is a big fan of the book. And, you know, he really likes it. He told me he really liked it. And so, you know, we're going to Bruce's dressing room and Little Steven goes to me, goes, did you sign a book for him? And I go, I go, no. He goes, what, are you too freaking good to sign a book for Bruce? I go, no, Steven, it's not that. I'll sign it. It's arrogant. It's a little pompous, you know. I sign a book for Bruce Spring. Here, Bruce, here's my book, and I signed it for you. And he goes, okay, I understand. Sign a freaking book. Which I did, you know. But Ringo was great, so he wanted a signed copy. And when I was in Los Angeles, his assistant was trying to find me to get me to sign it. And I said, look, during the tour, I'll meet up with them all. So I called up, and I took my wife and son. And my son grew up with the Beatles, so he's 18. And so for him, he was like watching him sitting on the couch, watching Ringo just interact. And he was great. I mean, these guys are a really sweet guy. So when we were done, we were having dinner or whatever in a green room. My son goes, Dad, he's just like he is in Hard Day's Night and Help. I go, he's a Beatle. He wasn't acting.
We are talking with Andy Babuk, who is the author of Beatles Gear, now out in the Ultimate Edition. We'd love to get you into the conversation, too. If you've got a question about an artifact or about an instrument that the Beatles played, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. On Twitter, I am at Scott Feibusch, and Andy, you are at Andy Bubuk, right?
Yes.
On Twitter. So feel free to ring in with your questions, too. We've left Andy's phone on vibrate just in case Richie happens to call up and wants to chime in on a point here. We'd certainly be delighted to talk with him. Some of the early stuff, I want to get back to the very earliest chapters, because you're tracking down what were essentially, you know, like cheap dime store instruments that they're playing at the beginning that were certainly never intended in 1957 or 58 to still be around as artifacts 60 years down the road. What's become of some of these earliest Beatle instruments, and how did you find them?
Well, the funny thing is my rationale behind that was anyone who's like been a musician or still is a musician, they could always remember their very first instrument clearly, vividly, because it was the thing that actually turned them on to playing. And I thought that was a great starting point with the Beatles as well, because John Lennon would always tell this story about he had this acoustic guitar that he bought from the back of a magazine, you know, and he always was humored by the sticker inside that it was guaranteed not to crack, you know. So, you know, that kind of stuff is really charming, and it really kind of helps set the tone of what they had to start with as far as musicians, and they produced music out of really inexpensive, cheap instruments. Another thing to point out is, before 1959, there was a trade embargo in England. You couldn't buy American-made instruments. So what you were able to find in England were cheaply made British instruments, were the very few, or imported things from Germany or Czechoslovakia. But the one that John Lennon played was actually from South Africa, the Gallatone. They were actually made in South Africa and imported to England. So kind of wacky. But it tells a great story, but it really kind of shows the true evolution. And being somewhat of a compulsive completist, I kind of get the whole story. I figured the beginning of them making music to the very end is the completest story.
You've got the picture of one of the surviving quarrymen with the T-chest bass there.
Sure.
Handmade staff on it, the musical notes.
Oh, yeah. Great stuff.
It's a great thing. I've got to imagine you're talking about how 99.9% of the calls that you get are about things that aren't authentic. I've got to imagine that there's an awful lot of stuff floating around that purports to be. Did you feel like you were breaking a lot of myths?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot. You know, there's, like, I had this guy haunting me for a good 10 years from England that he said he had John Lennon's Rickenbacker 1996, a little red one. And, you know, see, the problem is that I wrote this book, and I get hired by auction houses and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, different places like that to, you know, authenticate stuff. If I go and say something's real, they immediately turn around and go to an auction house and they try to sell it for a ton of money. So I have to be really, really careful. And I really don't like to talk a lot about it unless it's really, really, you know, the real stuff. But this guy was relentless. He was getting a hold of friends of mine to get a hold of me and say, no, this is really John Lennon's guitar. And what the guy didn't know, and I wasn't about to tell him, is that one of the times I was hanging out with Ringo, I go, so Ringo, you got any other cool instrument stories? He goes, yeah, one time John gave me a guitar. And I go, yeah, what is it? He goes, it's a little Rickenbacker, a little red one. And everybody thought it was stolen or something. And Ringo told me this great story. And it was something, I don't know, in the mid-2000s, he told me this story. And I was saving the story for this book. And I asked Ringo, I said, hey, Ringo, if I ever do another version of the book, would it be cool to photograph that guitar? Oh, sure, Andy, no problem. You know, so I had this story. In the meantime, this guy's haunting me. Oh, no, I have it. I have this story. He had this elaborate story. He had auction houses calling me and everything. I'm going, look, I'm not talking about it. It's not the guitar. We could prove it's the guitar. I'm going, look, I'm telling you, it's not the guitar. It's really not the guitar. And lo and behold, just last year, what was it, November, December, Ringo did that big auction, and it was unveiled that this guitar, you know, existed and Ringo had it. Well, in the meantime, this guy, the charlatan from England that actually had this guitar that he was trying to pose as John Lennon's, he sold it to some rich guy for $500,000, right? So now the rich guy's getting a hold of me. He goes, how do you know for sure? You know, I don't want to get my money back. And I'm going, I don't want to know anything about it. You know, just stay away from me. You know, so it's wacky what goes on. You know, there's a lot of everybody wants it to be the Beatle thing because then they could cash in, and I got to be really careful about it.
Absolutely. We are talking with Andy Babiuk, who is the author of Beatles Gear, Ultimate Edition. We will take a quick break here on Connections with Evan Dawson. I'm Scott Feibusch sitting in with Evan. We'd love to get your calls in as well, 844-295-TALK, when we return with Andy Babiuk. On Tuesday's Connections, Summer Book Week continues. We'll hear from local bookstores and librarians in our first hour about how their work is changing. Then in hour two, Rochester's Sonia Livingston joins us to talk about her new essay collection, Ladies' Night at the Dreamland. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson. Check out our entire Summer Book Week lineup at WXXINews.org and join me for Connections Tuesday at noon and again at 9. And it is Connections. It is Summer Book Week, and it is Summer Book Week leading up to Jazz Festival Week in Rochester, which means we wanted to spend some time talking about music, and one of the most impressive music books that has come out in quite a while from a local author, no less, is Andy Babiuk's Beatles Gear, the Ultimate Edition. We are talking about Beatles instruments. We're talking to you at 844-295-TALK, and I actually want to step away from the Beatles for a second because you also were the co-author of Rolling Stones Gear. Talk to me a little bit about that process and why don't the Stones get quite so much fanatical devotion as the Beatles do?
You know, I think, you know, I'm a huge Stones fan, huge Beatles fan, probably equally. But there's a certain aura that the Beatles have that the Stones, they just don't have. Great band also, way longer career. But I think that's the key difference. Whenever you take something away from people and they can never have it again, that's when they want it more. And I think, you know, the Beatles, relatively short career, if you think about it, they say 10 years, but really it was more like, you know, eight, really. I mean, 8 years, if that. And what they did and how prolific they were in that short.
How young they were.
Yeah. I mean, young guys in their 20s and how prolific and what they created and what they did, it's pretty astonishing. And I think, and it went away, and it never came back. And I think people always just wanted it, so they just kind of, it's like almost magical. The Stones, though, I mean, that they have their own magic dust as well.
In more ways than one.
Yeah, if you could imagine that, right?
So how did that process come about to go from doing Beatles Gear to doing Stones Gear?
Well, my publisher had asked, you know, after the Beatles Gear came out and it was quite successful, what's your next book? I said, I really don't want to do another book. And they're like, well, no, you should do one. Who would you do it on? And I said, well, the next best band is the Stones, so it would be the Stones. What would it take for you to do a Stones book, they asked me. This is at a British pub, like we're at a pub and having a bunch of ales, like, four down, right? And so I'm a little lit, and I'm going, well, a lot of money would do it. And, well, we don't have a lot of money. I go, well, that's typical, you know, typical publisher. I said, well, you get it so I can hang out and get drunk with Keith Richards, and I'll think about it, right? Okay, we'll make it happen. So
it's potentially a very dangerous request right there.
Well, I'm up for the challenge. I always am. But you know, it was a much longer career, so it's a lot harder to do. It was a lot more work. And, you know, it's not like somebody just pays you to stay home and write books all day. So I was doing it in between everything else I do, you know, working, you know, selling guitars and playing in a band and whatnot. But it was great because then I got to actually hang out and go through all their actual real equipment and play a lot of Keith's guitars. I actually was able to play one of his famous Macabre Telly through his amp rig on stage. You know, it's like, wow, that's like, yeah, that's cool. You know, it's a lot of like neat stuff. I was at Bill Wyman was like the band's archivist, you know, so he was the historian. So the other guys, you know, what you find is when you interview a lot of these kind of guys, they don't remember. They physically just don't remember. And a lot of times they don't care either. So it's not that important to him. And here I am trying to get factual details. So Bill invited me to his home in London. So I went over there and had don't know, 450 pictures in chronological order, showing him stuff. And he was great, and he told me a lot of stuff. So to me, it was great to, like, hang out with these guys and actually try to help catalog it. And they really loved the book. They used it to just do their museum thing in London, so it was fun.
That's interesting. With the Beatles, I don't get the impression that any of them early on, you know, except maybe I get the impression maybe that Aunt Mimi was saving some of this stuff. Yeah. With an intent to seeing the history there, but they certainly weren't early on, right?
Well, they're young guys. They're like kind of just in a whirlwind of like craziness, you know? I don't think it really hit them until after. Although Ringo, he's a big Beatle fan. He's got a lot of the stuff, you know? He likes it, you know?
That's cool. I'm going to go to the phones here. And Paul in Rochester, you are on with Andy Babuke on Connections. Welcome.
Well, hi. I'm a big fan of Andy's work and his books. Really extraordinarily well written and articulate, I got to say. A question for you, Andy. The Beatles, known for all their great work on their instruments, but they're also a fabulous vocal band. Any comment about the microphones that they used, or is that part just beyond the scope of the research of the books?
Well, Paul, it's, you know, we do touch on that. It would really fall into a whole different category. I mean, I didn't focus on the recording equipment as much because that's a whole different topic. And EMI in itself, that's a story, you know, that famous Abbey Road Studios. So the microphones are really part of the studio. But, you know, the Telefunkens and the Neumanns that they used are pretty well documented, but then a lot of other great bands use that same studio. Everybody from the Hollies to Pink Floyd to, you know, the list is endless. That's a hugely famous studio. And I actually left that side of the equipment tale a little bit more open-ended because it's a story in itself and it deals with EMI as a studio. And a friend of mine, Brian Cahew, actually picked up the ball and wrote an amazing book about the recording equipment that the Beatles used. And it focuses on EMI, the studio. And that goes into great detail about it.
Everybody's got their particular obsession.
Sure.
Absolutely. More from the phones here at 844-295-TALK here on Connections Summer Book Week with Andy Babuke and Karen in Webster. You're on with Andy.
Yes, thank you so much. I heard you talking about the Rolling Stones, and I do have interest in that and their little magic dust. I own a Glockenspiel, and I was wondering, if you don't have, you have a huge archive of photos, but if you don't have a photograph and you have an instrument, can you look at its pitch or tone from previous recordings and then compare that to what the musical instrument is producing today to authenticate an instrument?
No, the musical pitch of an instrument is too ambiguous, so that's impossible. That you know, well, you could get the same instrument to create different pitches just by recording it differently with different microphones, as the other guy was asking. So, no, that's physically impossible.
Sure. Because the metallophone, in its nature, its pitch and tone stays constant. It doesn't change over time.
Yeah, but if they manufacture them in a factory, they're made to sound the same. So it's a moot point.
Actually, the instrument that I have is actually handmade. There's no other, it's handmade. It's not a factory-made instrument.
Oh.
So that's why I was asking. So I was just wondering if it's possible.
Scott, what did I tell you about 99.9%?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a fantasy that I have, for sure.
Yeah, it sounds like a real good fantasy.
Yeah, and I do own it, and it was just a whim. It had nothing to do with picking it up because I thought it had anything to do with, but it just piqued my interest to find out where this instrument came from and who owned it previously.
You can always hang on to the dream. There's nothing wrong with dreaming.
Dreaming is free.
We enjoy it. It's a great story, and we enjoy it. But I was wondering if you could actually do it by pitch or tone from a recording.
All right,
thank you so much for your answer.
Thanks for the question, Karen. Kind of related to that, there's a question from an off-air caller wondering where people can hear the difference between some of these instruments. Is there a source? Do you have samples on a website? Are there places they can go on some of the Beatles CDs to hear?
No, not really. I do play these clips when I do an audio-visual presentation. I haven't – well, I think the last one I I did here was at the George Eastman House a few months back. I'm doing one this coming weekend, actually, in Nashville at the Country Music Hall of Fame. So if you're in Nashville, come and see it. And I think they're streaming it as well. So okay. If you go to their website, you could check out some cool examples that
I
show.
We will look for a link to that. If we can find one, we will put it up on our Summer Book Week page and make sure that people know where to find that. And I'll put a plug in here. If you do get a chance to go see Andy give his presentation, it is fascinating. I'm not even a musician, and I learned a ton about their instruments. I walked away feeling so much more informed.
Did you want to hear the Beatles songs differently then? All right, great.
Absolutely. I think there's no way you could have written this book without being a musician, is there?
Well, I think it's a unique perspective because I wrote it solely from a musician's viewpoint. And a lot of the happenstance that happened to the Beatles, a lot of people think, you know, they got certain instruments because there was a reason and there was magical and there's, you know, a mystic reason why it all happened. And there really wasn't. And that's the one thing when I was finished with the book and I looked at it, I go, wow, they were just a band and they did what band guys do. You get a new instrument, it's a new toy, you go in the studio, try to make noise with it. That's what the Beatles did. They did what typically musicians would do. So a lot of times when, you know, people would have all these reasons, oh, they got this because of that. No, it's more basic than that. I mean, you got to think like a musician thinks, and they were musicians.
There's a whole little subtext here, too, especially in the early years. You mentioned about the tariff issues. There's a sort of a whole little subtext here about music retailing in, you know, outside of London in the late 50s and early 60s. And, of course, Brian Epstein through NEMS had a whole role in that. So there were favored suppliers, certainly, at least.
Well, yeah. I mean, and again, I mean, their reasoning and their choices that they made really – the end result would be, well, it showed up on their records. And we're taking the records and the recordings for granted. We're just saying, oh, that's a Beatles song. Well, what went on to make that song, you know, not just the songwriting? There's a whole plethora of other information that creates it, you know, be it, you know, what we talked about with studio equipment, but then also the equipment they brought in to record with.
And you mentioned, too, you've got, I think, quite a bit more now in the new book on the amps that they were using when they were going out on tour, and it's amazing in any kind of contemporary context how little amplification they had and how lousy these amps were.
Oh, yeah. You know, imagine going up, you know, roll up in a baseball stadium, right, and you have a 100-watt guitar amp and a 100-watt bass amp and a drum set, and there's one microphone on it. And, okay, you're playing through a bunch of Shure Vocal Master columns, something like that, you know. Not much more. And they're singing through where the announcers would sing. You know, I mean, it's pretty pathetic if you think about it. And you got all these young kids screaming at the top of their lungs, and you got to play over that. And they had no monitors. They're just like good musicians. They're just singing what they thought. All right. Ringo told me this one thing in England specifically, when they'd play these theaters that were so smaller, it hold like 1,500 people, kids were screaming so loud, they couldn't hear themselves on stage. So they would do this joke where they would stop playing purposely for like 3 bars of a song or 4 bars and then start playing again just to see if anybody noticed, and no one would notice that they didn't play. He told me one time his kick pedal broke on his kick drum, and he just didn't use it. He goes, what do they know? They couldn't hear us anyhow, you know. But, you know.
And you wonder why they stopped touring.
Yeah, right.
I want to get back to the phones here at 844-295-TALK here on Connections Summer Book Week. And Patrick is with us from SOTUS with a question about a guitar. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Thank you. I had heard a few years ago that Bill said, and I knew this to be true, the SG that they used in the studio, you mentioned guitars going up at auction. Could you give a really prominent example and what the thing was that guitar now? Was it bought?
I think
you're fading in and out on us.
Your cell phone ability out in SOTUS is not good, but you know, I think I got the gist of the question. The George Harrison guitar, when it went up for auction, they contacted me, and it was the brother of the guy from Badfinger that had it The wood grain matched 100%. It did sell at auction, and a friend of mine, Jim Irsay, from who's the owner of the Colts football team, he actually bought it, and he still has it. Jim is actually the collector that has the largest amount of Beatles equipment other than the physical Beatles themselves. He's the guy who bought the drum set and the drum head and that Gretsch guitar that I was talking about that John Lennon had. He bought that and that SG. He's got a lot of stuff. It's pretty cool.
Thanks for the call, Patrick. Is there a Holy Grail that's still out there that hasn't been found?
Yeah, I think it's Paul McCartney's first bass. It was stolen in the late 60s from, you know, EMI Studios. And I had a line on it at one point, but it went away really quick. But Paul said he wants it back. He really wants it. They actually filed a formal police report about it. It was his very first Hofner Beetle bass that he bought in Germany. And so that's kind of a holy grail. It was used on a lot of stuff. I'm sure if that popped up, it would never hit auction. Paul would just get it back, you know.
You must, and without asking you to divulge any confidences, you must get to meet some interesting people and see some places that nobody knows exists as part of all of this.
Yeah, I've been in some odd places.
I'll bet.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting.
On the Lennon end of things, what's out there on the Lennon end of things?
Most of his stuff is accounted for, actually, you know. Maybe his Sonic Blue Strat, but it's hard to actually, you know, match that up because it's a color, so you can't see the wood grain. We did find his famous Gibson J160E that he wrote all those great songs on. And before it went to auction, I predicted that it would be the highest priced guitar ever sold because it was the guitar that he used to write a lot of famous Beatles songs. And it went missing in the early 60s, and I found it. It was one of these guys that called me. Oh, I think I got John Lennon's guitar. Yeah, all right. Send me a picture. And then, lo and behold, the picture, holy crud, this is the guitar. You know, so the guy who had it, I said, look, you got a great problem on your hands because right now that guitar was reported stolen and you're sitting on it. And what do you want to do with it? He goes, well, I want to sell it if it's the real thing. I said, well, you're going to have a nightmare because I just went through this thing with Bob Dylan with the Newport Folk Festival guitar that when Dylan first went electric. And the person who had it, they didn't want to play ball with Dylan, so Dylan sued him. So I said, Dylan's got a lot of money, trust me. Yoko Ono has way more money because she has the whole Lennon estate. You don't want to mess with her. Make nice with her, and I can help you. And I put him in touch with Yoko, and I said, look, you guys work out a deal, and I'll help you, but you gotta do it the right way. And they did, and it sold at auction, and I predicted it was going to be the highest-priced guitar ever sold. The most expensive guitar was just under $1 million, and it was the Dylan guitar. This one sold for almost $2.5 million.
I'm glad you brought up Dylan, because you mentioned before about your preference for books and memoirs that are written chronologically, and I'm thinking, wow, you must not have liked Bob Dylan's Chronicles when it came out. It kind of opens the question, since we're doing this for Summer Book Week and since we're talking about music writing, what's out there that you've read recently that has impressed you? What should people be reading right now if they're looking for some good music books this summer?
Well, you know, Beatle-related, that Mark Lewisohn is, you know, it's great. I mean, his project is a mammoth project. He's writing everything about anything to do with the Beatles from day one till the end.
Every minute of everything that they did.
And he's a great friend of mine, and we, you know, he'll often run into any kind of equipment questions, and he'll, you know, he's working on the second book now. Any equipment questions, I'm his go-to guy. But in the same token, he was the guy that if I found a photo when I was doing this new layout, I would just email it over to him. Hey, Mark, can you talk? And he'd know the date, exactly where it was shot, everything. You know, he's the best, you know. So I would suggest his book's great, wonderful.
In terms of other music writing that's out there, I know Patti Smith's had a couple of excellent memoirs that have come out lately.
There's a lot of really good stuff out there, you know, and more you see them. The sad thing is they come out, but they're out of print soon after, you know. One of my deals with my publisher is it can't go out of print. If it goes out of print, I can reverse back to me, and I'll put it back in a print. So So with that said, you know, things like the books that you mentioned, buy them while you can because they seem to go out of print quickly.
It's amazing, you know, particularly speaking of the Beatles, I've had the chance to go to the Fest for Beatles Fans.
Oh, I've been there.
That takes place, and I know you have, and it's you know, there are books about everything. There are books about every little niche. Do you ever feel like there's a point where the Beatles fans run out of patience and say, no, I'm not interested in what brand of toilet paper Paul McCartney had sitting in his bathroom in 1964?
Well, I got to be honest with you. I try to distance myself from a lot of that kind of stuff because I think what I did is actual a historical document. I had a friend of mine point out from the Hard Rock Cafe. He was saying, you know, Andy, other than the Beatles anthology, you're the only author that actually got all four Beatle parties to actually play ball with you, you know? And he said, furthermore, think about this. You're the only author that ever actually got to work directly with the Beatles and directly with the Rolling Stones. No author ever did that. It's pretty far out. I never thought of it that way. I just do
that
stuff.
That is amazing.
Yeah, I just kind of do books. I don't really sit back and ponder about it.
It says something for what true expertise is, that once you start doing it, if you establish a name for yourself out there, that that people recognize. And I want to get back to the phones here. We've got just a few minutes left at 844-295-TALK. Gerald in Hilton, you are on with us on Connections. Hi, Gerald. Gerald, you there? Gerald? I think Gerald may have gone away here. All right, we'll see. Gerald, if you want to try back, we will try to get you again.
Yeah.
Somewhere on here. You mentioned having worked a little bit with Dylan. You've talked about having a relationship with the E Street Band. Beyond the Beatles and the Stones, is there anybody else out there, do you think, that can merit this kind of meticulous interest? I know I would, being a huge Springsteen fan, I would read E Street Gear in a heartbeat if you were to write it.
Well, Bruce was really kind. We were having dinner one time before a show, and you know, when Bruce talks, everybody kind of just shuts up and listens, right? And you know, he goes, Andy, I got to tell you, I really like, you know, in his voice, you know, he's, Andy, I really got to tell you, I love that book. I think they were working on, what is it, the Rising album, you know? And he says, you know, we were in the studio and Max was looking at this book, so I stopped and, what is that? He goes, this is a book, you know, about the Beatles equipment. And he goes, man, that book, it freaked me out because I started looking at it and we stopped the session so much where the producer sent out somebody to buy some more copies of it because Bruce wanted to see it. And, you know, here Bruce is telling his story. Everybody just shuts up and they're listening. I'm like, wow, this is great. Bruce is telling me this story. He goes, I'm going to tell you something I never told anybody before. And then everybody just is quiet in the room, right? And he goes, when I was a kid, I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, freaked me out. You know, that's why I wanted to play. But I love their music and I love the way they look, but I love the equipment as much. And I never told anybody that because I thought everybody would laugh at me because they thought I'd be kind of weird because I like their guitars and amps and drums as much as I like their music. And then I saw your book and I found out I wasn't the only weird guy out there. There's other, you know, so I go, Bruce, thanks, man. It's like great compliment. I felt like saying, could I use it as a quote?
Yeah, but, you know. I get the impression he's something of an archivist of his own stuff because you see what's been put out in some of these collections that he's done, and I get the impression that he's probably got something of an archive that could make
yeah,
a project like
Bruce
that possible.
Is a really private guy. You know, he likes to keep his privacy and stuff, and it's well respected. But yeah, he's, you know, he's a sharp guy. He knows what he's doing. You know, very cool. But I've had a lot of guys like that. You know, Bono and The Edge, when they got the book, they sent out their guitar tech to buy him one of every guitar in the book. Go find me, and not copies, and one of the original ones.
The original ones.
So, you know, they got a lot of weird, cool stuff like that. Yeah.
Is there a difference if you're playing on something that is original from the 60s versus a decent modern copy of it? You can tell the difference, right?
Yeah, you know, there's like with violins, as the wood dissipates moisture, it actually gets more lively. So if it's kept well, yeah, a lot of times it's much better.
Has Paul's original guitar cracked, or is it still?
It's been repaired a bunch of times, but he still uses it. You know, when I saw him in Buffalo after the show, I was talking to his guitar tech, John Hamill, and we were having a laugh. I had to bring them copies of the book, the new book, and I said, is that the copy? Because they had a copy made because he fell on stage and it almost broke. Mm. And And I said, is that the copy? He goes, no, he doesn't like the copy. He plays the real one. But every night he throws it, and Paul's got to catch it. I mean, you know, Paul throws it, and he's got to catch it. And it's like, I go, what happens if, like, you drop it? He goes, I get fired. That's all.
You don't drop it.
Yeah.
You just don't.
Yeah, but he likes it. So obviously he had a copy made, but he sees the real one sounds better.
They all, it's interesting, you know, all of them in a sense went back and revisited those early years. I think nobody more so than Paul. He's really gone back and done cover albums, and brought those songs out in performance.
Sure. Well, I think after so much time, he realized, wow, people, this is a cool catalog. I should sing it. I wrote it.
Have you ever been inclined to follow up post-Beatle years with the equipment that any of them have used?
You know, I've been asked that quite a bit. I've been asked to do a lot of books. That, to me, is not as great an interest, I think, to the general public. I mean, it's interesting to a point, but the Beatles have that, like we talked earlier, the special magic, you know.
And we should get a plug in here. Your store is Andy Babiuk's Fab Gear. It's over at the Packets Landing.
In Fairport, come and visit. Fairport, yeah. And we have plenty of copies of the book there. So if you want a signed copy, come and I'll be glad to sign it for you.
There we go. You don't have to be as uneasy about a member of the public as signing it for Bruce. Or...
Yeah, that's easy. I always say that's signing them's good. Easy, writing them's hard.
There you go. Andy Babiuk, thank you so much for being with us as we kick off Summer Book Week. Here on WXXI, just a quick plug, our friends over at Writers and Books have a Getting Started as a Freelance Writer class this evening with Ruth Thaler Carter leading that. We'll have more from Writers and Books on Thursday. The whole lineup for Summer Book Week is at our website, WXXINews.org. We'll have Sonia Livingston on tomorrow. I'm Scott Feibusch. Thank you to our producer, Megan Mack, to Kat behind the board, and to Lisa Feibusch for booking today's second hour as well. Thank you, Andy Babiuk. We will be back tomorrow with more Summer Book Week on Connections.
Thank you.